Edward, thank you so much for joining us in our boardroom today. We've been doing the podcast in the specific, Vision to Visionary for some time. We've been doing it for a couple of months, and this is the first time we've sat in our own boardroom interviewing someone. So it's quite apt based on the fact that you're obviously the CEO of the Nauru program, which has been widely talked about for the last, 8 weeks or so, probably a bit more now. We're obviously official agents of the program, which we're delighted about. As you know, having sat down a little bit last week, we're incredibly, number one, proud of that fact, and number two, excited about it. I think the program's come around at a time when the industry needs someone to stand up and really, I suppose, put a stamp of approval on it. And so again, just thank you so much for sitting down with me today. I think a good place to start, and I start a lot of the podcasts with this question, is citizenship by investment or residence by investment, for that matter, is still quite niche to many people. Mm. I'm sure niche to you in some ways as well. I've spent the last decade in it, so less niche. But how does someone, or how did you, can you give us a bit of background on yourself and what you did before citizenship by investment was on your doorstep and what that journey looked like?
Yeah. Citizenship by investment certainly is very niche. And I think if you ask me 12 months ago, would I ever be working in this industry, I probably would have laughed at you.
Yeah.
You know, the first time that I had read about the industry or learnt about the industry was in reading books about money laundering or dodgy money. And they had a chapter on the king of passports. It was about Dr. Christian Kalin.
Yes.
And talked a little bit about Henley Imposters, not so much because of, you know, any involvement in money laundering per se. It was more just talking about the industry and how the industry had evolved and you know, in the past had, you know, maybe been used by certain bad actors.
Yeah.
And so for me, when I was first approached to run the Nauru program office and run the Nauru Citizenship by Investment Unit, actually, I thought I will never do this. I'd be crazy to do this. I had a really, you know, strong career in banking and, yes, and in risk and compliance. And, you know, the industry kind of came out of nowhere. And I had this probably a misconception in terms of what the industry was actually like. And I think that's quite a common misconception for people outside of the industry. So I'll tell you a little bit about my background anyway.
Please, yeah, that's helpful.
So prior to joining the industry and taking on the role as CEO of the Nauru Citizenship by Investment Program, I worked in banking and I worked in compliance, and I had a long history working with HSBC.
Yep.
I worked with them both in New Zealand, which is where I'm from, and also in Hong Kong.
Okay.
I started out in corporate banking, so I have a sales background, both in New Zealand in terms of the relationship management, and then more in terms of corporate strategy and sales strategy across the Asia Pacific region.
Okay, that's nice and broad. Yeah.
Then somehow I ended up working in the financial crime team for HSBC, again in more of a regional role, looking at it from a governance and oversight perspective. So in Hong Kong, but looking after 19, 20 odd markets in the region.
It's a good wide net, yeah.
And through that, I was able to get some really interesting experience and exposure to, you know, understanding the risks and how to mitigate those. I then had the opportunity to return to New Zealand with HSBC, where I worked as their chief compliance officer.
Super.
So we had a team there covering the financial crime compliance side of things, which is money laundering, sanctions, fraud, tax evasion, both in terms of setting policy as well as doing investigations.
Okay.
And then our team also managed the regulatory compliance side of things, which is looking at the evolving, you know, banking law and how does the bank then, you know, evolve, or how do they comply with those requirements.
Of course.
So coming back to the investment migration industry, you know, and how I ended up here, you know, I, like I said, I never thought I would work in this space.
Yes.
But when I got to know the people working in the industry, and also specific to the Nauru Economic and Climate Resilience Citizenship Program.
Yes.
Understanding what the purpose of the program for actually inspired me, because I saw it as an opportunity to have a material impact on the people of Nauru.
Yes.
And we can talk a bit more about this
later.
In terms of the purpose of the program. So the people attracted me. I'm very fortunate in that because my experience is quite unique in that you won't find many people out there with both sales and compliance background.
Yeah, not often do you find it in that order either when someone goes from sales to compliance. Sometimes compliance to sales or business development, for lack of a better word. But yeah, very unique.
And what is really cool from my perspective is I'm now in a role where I can marry those two up.
Sure.
Almost perfectly. You know, there's such a heavy financial crime risk side of this.
Yeah.
Being able to bring my experience from banking and managing a heavily regulated organization is very helpful.
Yes.
And then also having a very strong sales focus as well.
Sure, sure.
So I have to say I'm loving it, loving being in this industry. I'm only 6-7 months in now.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say the misconceptions that I had when I came in are very much misconceptions.
I was going to say that, yeah. What I will say is that, I mean, number one, unfortunately, like, I don't think investment migration is the only industry that suffers from this. It's kind of, I guess, bad news is a little bit wider spread than good news. So you could kind of, to put a number on it, do 2,000 above board families that actually need it for the right reasons and are making a materially good impact on a nation such as Nauru. And then you could have someone that becomes a citizen of a certain country and 6 months later does something nefarious, and that then causes a stir, which unfortunately then has a trickle-down effect. So I think the fact that, number one, your background being in compliance and sales makes such a big difference shows, number one, yes, there's a need to sell it. Of course there is. There's a need to market everything in this. Without marketing or sales, you're not going to get anything over the fence. But the truth of the matter is that without the compliance, which I think people forget about sometimes, you don't really have an industry that to sit in. So compliance plays such a big role, and I think sometimes is understated in our industry, yes?
It is, and I think in many industries, even banking, I mean, you've seen it evolve quite a lot over the last 10 years in terms of the checks that the banks have. Now, a lot of the friction caused is more so due to, you know, maybe poor process design rather than actually really understanding the risks and applying it in a pragmatic way.
Yes.
So, yes, it is absolutely important. It's absolutely critical that you have robust processes, but it's also really important that they're designed in the right way.
Agreed.
That focus on mitigating the risks rather than just being a tick box exercise. So, yeah. It does have a very important role to play, but it's very important that it's done in the right way, that is pragmatic and commercially minded and actually mitigates the real risks.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And look, in the example that you gave before, you know, yes, these are the kind of things that keep me up at night. You know, yes, the design of the program and being able to mitigate those risks is really important. But we are not always going to get everything right. Mm. What's really important is that we have designed the controls in the right way. Because, of course, in the example you gave, if someone has never committed a crime, there are no matter how many checks that we do, no matter how deep we go in terms of the due diligence, we'll never find anything because there is nothing to find.
Exactly.
Yet.
Exactly.
What we do have is we have continuous monitoring
yep.
on the successful applicants,
mm-hmm.
and we have the right design of the program that gives the country protection, talking sure. about passport revocation, that protects the program in the future so that the monitoring would pick up on anything negative that they had done in the future, and you have those protections in place
mm-hmm.
For the country to revoke their citizenship.
Absolutely, yeah. You see, it makes a material. What I will say is two things. So number one, having seen the evolution of the industry over the last, I guess, almost two decades, what I think has happened is you need clear compliance and clear future tracking, but you say you don't have, no one has a crystal ball, I wish I did, but you cannot forecast as much as we'd like to sometimes, and I guess compliance and the right structures allow us to get as close to forecasting as possible. But what I will say is I think the benefit that you and your team currently have is we've seen so much ebb and flow across citizenship by investment in the last two decades, especially actually over the last 2 years, which is why your program is such a breath of fresh air, as I've said before. I think if you can get real buy-in from your team within the unit from day one and really let them kind of understand what that need is and what that looks like, because the truth of the matter is, as you said at the beginning of the conversation, people, let's say for every 10 applications you do, I think there's a misconception that the reason for why people do citizenship by investment, I think there's a deep misunderstanding about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And this is, again, when before I came on board, that was one of the first questions I asked. Why would anyone want a Nauru passport?
Yeah.
To be honest, I had no idea. I mean, I hold a New Zealand passport, so yes. I've never had any challenges in terms of mobility or applying for a visa. Applying for a visa for me is almost a novelty.
Sure.
But for many out there, it's a real challenge. And the example that was given to me was, you know, maybe you're a Bangladeshi or Pakistani businessman.
Fair
and
enough.
You know, you want to go and do business easily in another country. And
exactly.
every time you go there and you apply, you have to apply for a visa.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just dip in and dip out. And often, you know, you need to be in another country at short notice, particularly if you have a business there. And so it's just a matter of being able to do business easily.
Yeah.
And that was an example that was given to me. And actually it really hit home. Understanding some of the challenges that other people have out there that you don't think of. And we've seen this already in terms of the applications that we've had coming through the program, the different reasons and rationale for people wanting a secondary citizenship. It's quite broad and quite unique to their individual circumstances.
Exactly. And never is it a one-size-fits-all either, just to be clear. I mean, The industry's evolved so far, and I think you and I touched on this when we first sat down last week, and we don't have to go into specific nationalities, but what I will say is that it's evolved so, it used to be for lack of a better word, a kind of a third world national that was needing it for visa-free access, but it's more than that. It's legacy planning. Mm. It's future planning for children because future generations for that matter. It's, I guess, in some instance, an insurance policy. Like insurance, you don't need it until you need it.
Exactly.
So it's a nice to have for sure. I also think we've seen with, I suppose, some shifts globally in places like Europe and even North America, for that matter, we've seen a real appetite for citizenship by investment in those jurisdictions too. So no longer is it simply for passport strength in terms of visa-free travel, but it really is a hedge against certain instabilities that I guess people feel like they don't or may not have control of. So it's evolving at a rapid pace, Edward, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So what I want to go back to is just your journey into investment migration for a second. So you come from a robust and what sounds like a very successful banking sector. When does the conversation start? When do they say, Edward, look, we've got a problem? What does that initial inception look like?
I got approached really out of the blue.
No application.
I got approached th- through a headhunter on LinkedIn.
Unbelievable.
And again, when I first saw it, I was like, is this a scam? To be honest. And then, you know, when I first talked to the people, then actually I started to understand what the proposition was.
So you had a vague understanding of the industry.
Very vague.
Yeah.
Very vague. And I would say I had a lot of misconceptions about the industry. I just thought it was, you know, to facilitate criminal activity. And actually that is very, very small portion.
Fortunately not the case.
Of the industry. But I think that's you know, I had the challenge of trying to explain to my parents what I was doing, you know, and because they were struggling to explain it to their friends.
Yes.
And I remember my mum coming to me and, you know, she had said to one of her friends, oh, isn't that illegal? It just gives you an idea of some of the
misconceptions
that are out there. But no, I got approached in a way completely out of the blue. I wasn't looking for another role. I'd actually started working for another financial services company. At the time, I had left HSBC because we had sold our retail business in New Zealand. So I had effectively structured myself out of a job. I'd not long found another role, maybe 8-9 months in, which was a fantastic role as head of compliance for another listed financial services company. Super. And great culture, loved working there. Was not looking for another role. This one came completely out of the blue. Again, when I started talking to the people that were involved and I understood what we were trying to achieve with the Nauru program, I really changed my perception entirely.
Yes.
And now that I'm here, I have absolutely no regrets because I'm absolutely loving it. I'm loving the people in the industry. There are some really interesting characters out there for sure. I really like the variety that I get in the day-to-day. I mean, you know, I can go from meeting with government stakeholders. I've met with individuals from the Asia Pacific Group, which is the sister arm of the Financial Action Task Force, so really getting stuck in on the financial crime side, and for me as a subject matter in this space, I really enjoyed that and having that conversation, meeting with ambassadors and you know, getting them comfortable with how we're running the program. I really enjoy that variety that this industry has.
Super.
And, you know, meeting with the likes of yourselves and working with our agents to try and understand what our place in the market is and trying to bring everyone together, I think, is just really interesting.
Yeah, you guys, I mean, have really hit the ground running. You've done a superb job. What I will say is, I've not seen, and I don't think any of our senior colleagues have seen or any of our directors have seen, any investment migration country or offering engage in dialogue with agents this early on in the process. Mm. So it's unique in that you've taken the time to do that and gather that information and really dive into the data and what that on the ground. I'm sure, I mean, you've been in Dubai for how long now, or the UAE?
12 days.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine you could soak up a hell of a lot in 12 days here because it is a little bit of a fishbowl at times. Mm. So you must have seen quite a few bits and bobs while you've been here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is actually my first time in Dubai, so just that alone, it's such a unique place.
Yeah.
So that alone has been quite eye-opening to me. I would describe Dubai as both a dream and a nightmare. But it's really a fascinating place. And specifically when you're in this industry as well.
Of course.
And the characters that you meet.
Yeah.
I'm really, you know, you talk about how we are engaging with agents so early on in the process. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why that was so important to me. And I think firstly, you know, we are a new program.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I'm trying to get as much feedback early on in terms of what is working well and what is not.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we can take action to try and tweak things or relook at policies that are maybe not working well. And I really want our you know, focus our work with agents to be very relationship driven.
Yes.
Because we need to work together to make this a success.
Invaluable.
And we are coming in new, so, you know, we are competing for attention. And I think that is something that's really important as well. You know, there are some challenges that we face in terms of awareness, not only about the program, but awareness about Nauru. So what can we do to try and address that?
Mm-hmm.
So these kind of challenges. But for me, it's really about building that relationship, having a very collaborative approach. You know, yes, of course, we're not going to do everything that you want us to.
Understandably so.
You know, we can go away and we can consider that in terms of the risks.
Yep.
But it is really important that we also build a program that is commercially pragmatic, is user-friendly, And I'll give you an example of some of the things that we have identified. We require medical checks on applicants, and one of the things that we asked for was a doctor's certificate.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that we asked for the doctor's certificate is we want to be able to verify that they are a legitimate practice.
Understandably.
And that seems to me like a reasonable thing to ask for.
It does.
But we've had feedback in Hong Kong, as an example, as a market where one of our other agents had gone around trying to get one of the doctors to provide the certificate, and I think they went to 24 different doctors and only one of them was actually willing to provide the certificate.
Wow.
So a simple approach for us to address that was we have a list of approved doctors that you can use.
Good.
So just a simple thing
that actually was quite simple.
It seems to me like a really simple thing to get.
Yeah.
And I can tell from your reaction it seemed like a really simple thing. But actually in some markets it can be quite a challenge. And so understanding what some of those challenges are and how we can approach it is really, you know, what we're trying to achieve. And that's a really simple thing for us to fix.
Yeah.
That actually improves the client experience in a big way.
Yeah.
You know, and that can save them weeks and huge amount of hassle running around different places.
Yeah.
And of course, because this is the first time we're going through it, you know, you come across these teething issues and you figure out how that agility
you don't see across investment migration. So the fact that you, specifically yourself, and I'm sure that trickles down to your team, is that agile and that engaged in dialogue, I think can only be a good thing. It can only be a good thing. Yeah, incredible.
That's really positive feedback for us so far. I mean, I'm just doing what I think is the right way to approach it.
Yeah. As you know, I mean, we've onboarded some applications with yourselves already, and just the initial dialogue has been incredibly helpful. From things that seem, I guess, to some perhaps trivial, like accessing certain CRMs or accessing certain logins, just the response times, even with the time difference at hand, has been incredibly good. So I commend you and your team on that for sure. What I want to touch on, Edward, before, I don't know how much time we have left, but what I want to touch on, and you spoke to it at the beginning, was the Higher Ground Initiative. Mm. You said you sat down and you kind of understood, look, there's some real, what's the word, heart behind this and some real good initiative behind this. Can you elaborate a bit on that for our viewers?
Well, let me maybe wind back the clock a little bit and talk about Nauru itself, because that is probably the better place to start in terms of understanding the context of the program and understanding some of the challenges that we are trying to address. So I don't know how much you know about Nauru, but...
More than I did 3 months ago,
I think that's the same for anyone certainly me. I mean, I'm fortunate enough to have travelled there a number of times already.
Okay.
You know, Nauru, it's a really interesting place. It was once one of the wealthiest countries in the world per capita because they had a rich phosphate resource. Unfortunately, you know, some of the wealth that was generated through that in the 70s, 80s and 90s has been mismanaged and they're no longer in such a favourable position. But that phosphate mining has left a huge scar and has had a massive impact on the island, and you know, probably 80 to 90% of the land is now barren, which means they cannot grow crops.
Yeah.
You know, the agriculture once was obviously really rich because phosphate is used in fertilizer.
Sure.
Is now, you know, unarable. They can't grow their own crops. And because of that, they have to import all their food.
I was going to say, that must drive importation, yeah.
And all of that food is highly processed. And so they end up with one of the world's highest obesity rates and diabetes rates because they cannot grow their own crops.
So a real 180 is due to mismanagement, essentially. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think a lot of the mining was done, you know, it started over 100 years ago. So this is over a long period of time. But obviously in those early days, you know, you don't have agreements in place that focus on restoring the land as you might do now.
Yeah, I guess it's a handshake agreement.
Which is unfortunate, but we are where we are today. And so they have major challenges in terms of the land.
Mm-hmm.
The landscape it's like being on Mars, you know, they've got these massive rocky pillars, you know, that are, you know, 2-3 meters high. And that's all been carved out, a lot of it by hand for the mining.
Yeah.
So a lot of these pillars, the formations are all man-made to a degree. They also have a very small freshwater supply, mm-hmm. and they have saltwater contamination in their freshwater supply. So, water security is an issue.
Yeah.
Energy security is an issue. So you have, fortunately, they've received funding from the Asian Development Bank around 2016, don't quote me on that.
Sure.
To build out their solar energy capability.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to 2018, 3% of the energy on the island was solar. Now they're at 50%, which is a huge improvement.
Very good, yeah.
The remaining 50% is all powered by a diesel generator. And at the moment, there are no solar or energy storage capability, no battery. So it's just use it or lose it.
Yes.
We talked about importing a lot of things earlier as well. So everything is imported to the island, mm-hmm. and they don't have proper waste management. So everything is just dumped on the island.
Goodness, yeah.
And there is not proper recycling facilities. So you've got all of this. And then to top it off, you have 90% of the population that live at low-lying sea levels.
Yep.
And with global warming.
I was going to say climate change.
And rising sea levels. We're starting to see increased flooding on the island, and these are homes and populations that are at risk.
Speak to the population size again, remind me.
It is small.
Yeah.
It is the world's third smallest country,
yeah.
with a population of around 12,000.
There we go, yeah.
It's such an interesting place.
Yeah, or 12,000 negatively affected citizens isn't a good look, regardless of the size. Yeah.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is still their home.
Exactly.
They need a place to live. So the government embarked on a highly ambitious project called the Higher Ground Initiative, which effectively plans to relocate 90% of those residents that are living at low-lying sea levels to the top side of their island, or the higher ground.
Makes sense.
Which is elevated above sea level,
mm-hmm.
and to effectively build an entire new community.
Wow.
So while, you know, 12,000 is a small number, it's also actually an achievable number to relocate almost an entire country's population,
yeah.
given the size.
Still ambitious, but yeah.
Incredible. Still ambitious, but yeah. to build that new... And this is what I get so excited about, because you have a really unique opportunity to build an entirely new, fully sustainable community where everything is interlinked.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can bring in, smart water reticulation systems. You have, new technology coming through in terms of water desalinization.
Yeah.
You have, new technologies coming through in terms of solar energy, or potentially, yes. They look at, wind generation,
sure.
I don't know. These are not new technologies.
Yeah,
but
turbine but and yeah.
There are lots of potential out there. of course, you know, energy storage is becoming more economical and more efficient as well. And what I think is really interesting is some of the new technology that's coming out in terms of gasification, you know, and so dealing with waste management, but also generating energy from that.
Sure.
So turning it into like LPG that can be used for cooking or, you know. And so it's these kind of technologies which they'll be using then to build these new communities in an entirely sustainable way.
What a noble, I mean,
you know, we have, you know, the country faces an existential crisis over time with rising sea levels that we need to help address. But also we have an amazing opportunity to build a new kind of community or ecosystem that can be used as a model for other small countries.
Of course, facing similar challenges.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, in the South Pacific alone, there must be challenges across that region. It makes sense. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, Nauru is one of the most vulnerable, climate vulnerable countries out there, but there are many others in that situation as well that, you know, don't have... just low-lying coastal areas, you know.
It actually reminds me, good question. So are the citizens living on the island being made aware of what the initiative is, and are they aware of how that funding works? How kind of receptive have they been to citizenship by investment or investment migration, or is there a dialogue there?
Yes, absolutely. There is a dialogue, and that is absolutely critical.
Yeah.
For the program's success, I think. You know, similarly, the local population have the same misconceptions that we talked about before. And also there's concern that the program is not going to be run really well, and that will have an impact. So we've done a lot of community engagement. We've met with community leaders. We've met with church leaders to talk them through how the program is being run, because they had concerns around, you know, is the due diligence going to be sufficient, or is it just going to be, you know...
Yeah, first come, first.
Exactly, right. Then what is that impact going to be on the country? So that was their primary concern. There's also a concern around property and giving them comfort that a citizen through the program, for example, and this is because of the different rights that native Nauruans have versus a citizen through the program, that they're not going to be buying up all of the real estate, as an example. And they can't do that because there are different rights
that
apply to local Nauruans. But protecting that real estate, again, and land is something that's really important to them, particularly as good quality land is so hard to come by at the moment. Also, trying to understand from their perspective, you know, are they going to potentially have a large number of people coming through the program then wanting to reside in Nauru, and what that impact could be? Because it could have a potential impact, particularly with such a small population.
Yeah. I think, look, traditionally that hasn't been the case, but I think if we've seen this, if citizens of an investment migration, and Nauru being the case study here, can buy into it. And I think, again, it comes down to dialogue from you and your team and the stakeholders. I think it can only be a positive thing. And I think what we've seen on the ground from a client-facing point of view is that Higher Ground initiative and the ability to engage in that dialogue and show potential future citizens how and where those funds are going and what an incredible impact it's going to have or likely to have is, only a positive thing. So... yeah, I think we are just about to wrap up, and I think you're going to sit with a colleague of mine. But again, I just want to end by saying you've done an incredible job at Inception. I thank you for your time again, and I look forward to my team and I having a long-lasting relationship with you and the guys. And, yeah, again, fantastic job, Edward.
Absolutely, and it's been a pleasure working with you so far as one of our key partners.
Yeah, thank you, Edward.